This is The Gould Standard, Episode 54, Cornelia Foss, Painting, Music, and the Love of Glenn Gould, Part 1.
Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Levine, and welcome to The Gould Standard, a podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation, currently celebrating our 40th anniversary year. And we're here once again, bringing you conversations with some of the most remarkable people from all across the world of the arts. If your life just wouldn't be complete without music, painting, sculpture, film, theater, poetry, and photography, then, friends, you have come to the right place. But first, while you're stopping by under our festively flickering neon piano sign, please do take a moment to press like, share, and subscribe. Kindly leave your comments, pose your questions, and be part of our community of friends and supporters. We also invite you to pay us a visit at our website, glenngould.ca. And when you're there and find yourself seized by the impulse to click that ever-present donate button, well, we'd be proud and honored to have you as a supporter. We are a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of friends like you. Now, today, we have a very, very special program for you. We will not only be speaking with a truly wonderful painter, but also with her family. Our guest is artist Cornelia Foss, whose career as a painter spans almost 70 years. She is acclaimed for her portraits, landscapes, and garden paintings, which prompted one reviewer to write, "For me, Cornelia Foss has always been special. It starts in the heart. She has some kind of tremendous faith in her work, or about herself, because whatever that spirit is, it travels in the veins and out of her hands, hands that apply the brushstrokes to her paintings, and something is translated, something happy and peaceful that conveys understanding." Now, Cornelia was married for 58 years to one of America's most brilliant and original composers and conductors, Lucas Foss, whose compositional output spanned the worlds of opera, symphonic works, chamber and solo instrumental repertoire. So Cornelia's life has been immersed in the arts, intersecting between the visual arts and music. And yes, for those of you who know about our namesake, there is a connection between Cornelia and the Glenn Gould Foundation, because for 4.5 years, Cornelia was in a loving relationship with Glenn Gould, which resulted in Cornelia and her two children relocating to Toronto, Canada. We'll get to that a little later. Also joining us are Cornelia's daughter, Eliza Foss, an accomplished actor from stage, screen, television, and voice work, who has recorded more than 150 audiobooks, and her son, Christopher Foss. Christopher is a documentary filmmaker. He's a writer, a poet, a photographer, and a consultant on sustainable business practices, and is also involved in many civil society organizations. Welcome, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Now, we're meeting at 6 p.m. because I understand, Cornelia, that you've been painting and that you like to stay busy until the sunlight goes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And do you paint every day?
Well, that's it. Sometimes I have to go to the dentist.
Well, I'm sure that the canvases will forgive those momentary absences. Cornelia, I'm fascinated by remarkable families and how some of them create a nurturing home for intellectual and cultural achievements down through the generations. So before we get to your life as a painter, your marriage to Lucas, your relationship with Glenn Gould, and your wonderful children, I'd like to talk a little bit about your family and your upbringing, which you were kind enough to share some details of with me. Although you're very much an American today, you didn't start out that way. In fact, you were born on the verge of a historically momentous time in an equally momentous place. Can you tell us a little bit about your family background, your parents, and possibly even a little bit about your grandparents?
Well, I had two sets of grandparents, like most people, and they were quite different. They're two totally different families. And my father was a classical archaeologist, as was my mother. They met at Heidelberg University in Germany. And I was a German baby. And when I was 6 months old, my parents moved to Rome, and I grew up in Rome. My early years were in Rome. It was about 6 years, until I was 6 years old. And I can't imagine a more wonderful place to grow up in than Rome and Italy. Spectacular. The beauty of everything that's around is amazing.
But it's also very interesting that your mother was an archaeologist like your father, because in those days it must have been quite rare for a woman to pursue that field and to be in a program of higher education. But I understand that she wasn't able to complete her PhD. Can you tell us a little bit about how that happened?
Well, yes, she was having an affair with my father, and her brother came to visit her and then happened to see her slippers under my father's bed when he went to see my father. And then, being a very bad brother, he went back and reported this to his parents. And the parents were absolutely outraged and said, she will have to immediately come home. We're not going to pay for another penny in that place. And my poor mother had to stop and come home, and she was in the middle of getting her doctorate, so she never got her doctorate.
That's such a pity. So she was basically condemned for being enmeshed in a den of archaeological sin.
I'm not so sure it was archaeological.
Well, they were discovering.
They were, yeah, exactly. They were making discoveries. Interestingly, I mean, from what I've read, on your father's side, there were high-level Lutheran clergy, and on your mother's side, it was banking and judges. Am I right about that?
Yes, and my mother was Jewish. My father was the opposite, very Christian. My grandfather on my father's side was the dean of the St. Lawrence Cathedral, which was one of the most beautiful cathedrals in Europe. It had a beautiful Riemenschneider statue at the very entrance when you walked in.
Fantastic.
Which I still remember.
In Nuremberg, right?
Yes.
And on your mother's side, were they Berliners?
They were all bankers. And my great-grandfather had started out as an accountant there and quickly jumped up the ranks and finally became president and owner of the bank. It was one of the four banks, and he became incredibly wealthy and had a very happy life, and also invented and also paid for the St. Gotthard Tunnel, which was a big deal. It united the northern part of Europe to the southern part.
That's incredible. And I understand that your maternal grandfather's bank ultimately merged with Deutsche Bank in the late 1920s.
It changed itself. It became the Deutsche Bank. And he might have probably turned around at his grave in total fury had he known that happened.
I understand. But interestingly, again, from notes and some reading I did about your mother, it sounds as though your mother was a very independent spirit from the time she was a child, that she insisted on going to the gymnasium, which was quite rare for young women at the time, and also that this interesting connection to the Lutheran world, that one of her childhood friends was the great future pastor, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who, of course, resisted the Nazis and was hanged in a concentration camp.
That was her closest friend. He lived next door, and they grew up together. They became incredibly close friends. In those days, that seemed perfectly fine. Nobody thought twice about it. It's sad that we live in a time when all these things become very interesting and strange and peculiar and opinionated.
Interesting that she was filled with the spirit to look for learning and knowledge. I read somewhere that actually when she was 18 years old, she went on a trip to Egypt.
Yes. When her father said to her, well, when you become 18, you could wish for absolutely anything you want. He adored her. She was his favorite daughter. when she was 18, he said to her, all right, have you thought about what you want? And she said, yes, I'd like a trip to Egypt. He got two of the servants, his most trusted people, to accompany her, and off she went to Egypt. And we have a photograph of her sitting on a camel and looking very proud.
I'd love to see that. That's great, because that would have been around the time of the great Egyptological discoveries, like the Tutankhamun tomb, which was in the early 1920s.
By the way, quite a few women took part in all those things. It's interesting. Women were much more likely to be educated and adventurous in those days than they are now.
So your parents got married, and even though your mother didn't complete her doctorate, she still was very much involved with the world of archaeology, working with your father, if I'm not mistaken. And they were married, and you were born in the early 1930s and grew up, as you said, in Rome. Now, what were your recollections? I think you stayed in Rome until you were, what, 6 or 7 years old?
Yes. My recollections are of that one of the most beautiful houses in Rome that we were living in. And it had a fantastic fountain at the entrance. But also in the basement where the kitchen was, there was a frog living in the drain. And I loved that frog. We had long conversations. But also I wanted to say, it was not just my mother who had an independent spirit, but also my grandmother, her mother. She was the first woman to ride stride saddle, because she did not want to ride side saddle. And, of course, they had lots of horses, and she was a very good rider. And she was in a show when the horse didn't quite make it over the, whatever it's called, and fell. And of course, the upsetting thing was that the horse fell on my grandmother. So my grandmother had a broken hip, but the horse was fine and got up. And my grandmother got back up on the horse and finished the course.
With a broken hip.
Yeah.
She was quite something.
What a remarkable family. I also discovered something very interesting about your father. It's a sort of a connection, which is that apparently his main professor and mentor was a very famous archaeologist named Ludwig Curtius.
That's right.
And when I read about Curtius, what I discovered, because this takes us back into connections to the world of music, that earlier in his life he had been a private tutor to the man who later became, or a boy at the time, the celebrated conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic, Wilhelm Furtwängler.
Really? Oh, I yes. didn't know that.
Yes, so
you really helped done your homework.
Well, but it's interesting because these sort of crisscrossing threads of music and visual art and history seem to be sort of baked into the cake of your life.
Astonishing. Well, of course, all the wealthy families in Europe taught their children or had their children taught music lessons. Mm-hmm. Either played the piano, the violin, all sorts of things. And that was absolutely normal in all these families. Right. Mendelssohn is a very good example.
Exactly, exactly. Now, I'm sure that, you know, being in Italy between the ages of 2 and 6, you probably weren't aware too much of what was going on socially or politically around you, but that was the height of the fascist era. Were you aware at all that there were, you know, strange things going on with strange people marching in the streets and that sort of thing?
Well, it wasn't exactly the height. It was the beginning, because I was there quite early. And yes, I was aware of the fact that suddenly I've written a memoir, which has not been published yet. I hope it will be one day. And I remember seeing these enormous army of young boys marching up the street. Suddenly everybody had to stop. The music started, and there they were. But they looked strange because they all had their eyes only on the head of the next boy before them. And I thought that was a very weird sign. That was an odd thing mm-hmm. doing. And I remember being frightened. I thought it's a strange sort of thing. And everybody else was clapping and cheering. I didn't think it was so good and so funny.
Were you being raised in German or Italian or a combination of?
Both German with my parents and Italian with the servants. And I was taken to a kindergarten, which I actually loved because it was run by French nuns. And the French nuns wouldn't allow anyone to speak anything but French. That was the only
thing
I didn't like.
So you were trilingual.
The nuns were so sweet. I just adore them. They loved playing with us and cavorting around. The sweetest human beings.
But that idyllic period didn't last. You had to leave.
Father got the German government one day in 1937, and the letter said, "Dear Dr. Brendel, as of the receipt of this letter, your position will be terminated because you are married to a non-Aryan, Heil Hitler, in Gothic script." And I found it many, many years later, and it sent a frisson up my back.
I can imagine.
It's such a dreadful, dreadful letter.
Your father is suddenly unemployed after being in a very select position in the archaeological and academic world. What happened?
What happened was that there was only one choice. Since he was not Jewish, he was allowed to go anywhere he wanted. So he could go to England, to America, and find a position, whereas my mother had to stay in Germany because that's where her money was. Jewish money was not allowed to be taken out of Germany. So it had to be stayed in Italy. She would have been bankrupt.
Right.
Now, my father went first to England and then to America because what he was trying to do was to save us. He had to get a position at a university so that he could say legally and sign a document that he would be responsible for his wife and daughter for the rest of their lives. That was what was required by America and by England. Probably 6 million Jews wouldn't have had to die if it hadn't been for that.
So he found a position in America.
He found a position as associate professor at Washington University in St. Louis. And the moment he got the position, he sent my mother a telegram, and the next morning we left. But in the meantime, we had to stay in Berlin.
Right. How long was that? How long were you in Berlin?
So I went
2 years.
German school for 2 years.
That must have been very dangerous.
I had no idea about any of it. No one told me a thing. The only thing was that the German school was so different from anything in my French kindergarten. For one thing, we had to stand up and say Heil Hitler in unison whenever the teacher came in. If we didn't say it in unison, we had to do it 20 times in a row with our arms up, Heil Hitler, and sit down, and Heil Hitler, and sit down. Well, that was a bit silly, I thought.
Well, a bit silly, but also very ominous. And I assume that the level of, you know, precision parades and screaming speeches on the wireless and all of that sort of thing. Were you there at the time of Kristallnacht?
No, I mean, I have no idea because it didn't affect us. My mother was living under an assumed name. We had a very nice apartment in the Grunewald. I knew about not anything. I mean, I had no idea about anything. I'd been kept totally in the dark. Also, the school that I went to was a school that was for rich little girls whose parents could afford it. No Jewish child had ever been there. It was a moot point. Jew never was heard. I'd never heard it. I had no idea what it was.
So you were a Brendel, but not a Weigert while you were there.
No, I was a Weigert. You're right. I was a Brendel because my father was Brendel.
Right. Let's see. If it was 2 years, you would have been about 8 or 9. So you must have at least been subjected to some of the ideological teaching? Because that would have been in all the schools, no?
No. No? Not a word.
Good for your mental health.
Yeah.
So you came to America, and you did you go immediately to Washington University with your father, or?
First for 2 years we were in St. Louis, and then he had a job at Indiana University, and I absolutely adored being in Indiana. I was pretty quick about learning English, and I became very American very soon. And I absolutely adored everything about Bloomington.
I was curious about that because, after all, you had been raised in two of the world's most beautiful cosmopolitan cities in a very intellectual and refined atmosphere. And suddenly you are in the, even though it's a university town for sure, it's still in the rural Midwest, but that didn't bother you.
Well, first of all, you have to know that, strange as it may seem, that in those years, the Midwest was incredibly liberal. I know it's not now, but it was then. Also, we had so many Europeans who were coming through who wanted to stay with us, which they did. Max Beckman was a good friend of my father's. All these other wonderful people who came and stayed. So I had a wonderful time talking to them and listening to them. Our dining room table was always full of extraordinary people.
You imbibed the Indiana spirit fairly quickly.
Well, Indiana was one of the most beautiful places, by the way. Indiana University is a fantastic campus, but also all the streets. Bloomington is the correct name for it. The trees lined the streets and were fantastic. Everything was so pretty. Wasn't something different, that different from Europe, except for, well, some specific things, but I won't go into all that.
But it's interesting because I associate Bloomington and Indiana University with one of the great music schools. It is a tremendous music school there, and many European musicians made their home there and developed great careers there. Like, for example, the great Hungarian cellist Janos Starker was there for many, many years. It's fascinating. But I didn't know, for example, that it had a fine archaeology department. It must have become fine, especially after your father arrived and your mother.
Also, we went to many wonderful concerts, because you're absolutely right. There were so many musicians there.
And it also interests me that your parents, in addition to their own academic focus on Greco-Roman archaeology and culture, were connected to a wider cultural world with people like Beckman and, you know, writers and people from across the intellectual spectrum. That it must have been quite a remarkable environment for you growing up, both, you know, when you were in Germany and in Rome, but also when you came to America.
Well, my father was one of the most free-thinking human beings I've ever encountered. And he gave lectures on Picasso. And Picasso was relatively new.
Absolutely.
And he came home with a book of Picasso drawings and etchings. And I just was absolutely enamored of all that. I began copying it and had a wonderful time.
Well, that actually you anticipate, because I want to talk about the point at which you began to think of yourself as becoming an artist in the future. And you know, were you always drawing? Did you always have a sketch pad from the time you were little, or when did that bug bite you?
Well, I began to draw when I was 5 and realized that I was going to be a painter very early. And also my parents were wonderful because they took me everywhere with them so that I would go to all these fantastic museums, especially in Rome. You can imagine, I mean, the extraordinary things that I was exposed to.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that by the time I got to Bloomington, I was really someone who knew a great deal about art and also really understood what hard work it is. And that to sit and practice and copy works of art were essential. So I did it morning, noon, and night.
Well, it's very interesting that you mentioned your father introducing you to Picasso because, you know, I have this image that a generation of young artists felt like they were following in Picasso's footsteps and making a great break with the past. But I'm going to guess that your parents' own upbringing gave you a sense of the continuity of art from the classical world through the Renaissance and the Romantic period into modern art. Did you always feel you had that kind of perspective?
No. What they really were able to do, which was really spectacular, was to show me how human beings feel the need to change with every generation and how totally different everyone thought they were. I mean, every young generation thinks they do demolish the older generation and do something totally new. And they taught me this and I understood it. So Picasso was something that was new. He really had a whole other perspective on how to do things and how to see things. And this was not because he thought it was so, he really did. Incredible. As a matter of fact, he still stands as a giant in the history of art.
And spanning not only because of the length of his career, many developments in modern art, visual art, but also many styles in his own art.
Well, I mean, he liked to take things from all sorts of different places. Demoiselle d'Avignon, for instance, is a painting that's based on African art. Nobody had really done that before. And afterwards, people did. And now, of course, everybody is very interested in African art. It became something that he really opened the door to.
What I find interesting is that you, over time, evolved a very personal style of your own, which really is, for example, you know, at least from what I've seen of your art, you didn't become a cubist. If I had to describe your work, it is a kind of a pastoral impressionist sensibility.
It's called painterly realism. And you know, as I tell my students, that in the same way that we all have different fingerprints, there's no such thing as developing a style. It's something that usually happens by itself. We happen to all be different human beings. And as we evolve, we obviously are going to do things that are our own.
Right. By the way, painterly realism is, I think, a wonderful way of expressing, and my mind was probably not accurate. Did you receive encouragement as you began to find your own visual voice?
Very much so, yes. First, my teachers at the school in Indiana told me that they realized that I was going to be a painter, and they gave me permission to go and take courses at the university 3 times a week. And my father was furious, actually, because he thought that scholarship has to come first. And finally, I was able to convince him that I really wanted to do this. And he said, yes. So I started seriously painting when I was 12.
Now, I read somewhere that you had a brief flirtation with sculpture. Is that correct?
Yes, I did. But then when I came to Los Angeles, quite a few years later, I was working on a marble statue, actually it was a portrait with a bit of a body, but anyway, I was hacking away at the marble when the whole nose fell off because I had found, unfortunately, there was a fault in the marble that I hadn't seen. And that made me decide, that's enough of that.
Well, you know what they say, the nose knows. You did not stay forever in Bloomington. You ended up back in Rome. How did that come about? Because obviously that was a very crucial turn in your life.
My father had a pre-to-Rome and a Fulbright later. So that meant 4 years in Rome for them. And I came along. And I wasn't allowed to stay at the academy because I was a child of a fellow. I first stayed at a Moorish-looking house a few blocks away, and then later stayed next to the academy with a very, very nice Italian female professor of archaeology, and she couldn't have been nicer, and her maid was a sweetheart, and I was totally spoiled there.
So you're back in Rome, but Rome after the war must have been a very different place than before the war, because it had suffered so much, and the people had suffered so much.
Absolutely. I had a best friend, one of the two daughters of Ludwig Curtius, and her name was Stella. And I absolutely adored her. And we were constant companions during the first part when I was in Rome. When I came back, we met at the Cafe Greco, and we had a whole afternoon together catching up, I kept listening to what she was telling me, and her story was terribly sad, because she told me that she had been taken to a camp that the Germans had for young women and young men who had no Jewish features, so in other words, tall and blonde and blue-eyed, and she was a beauty, and they were forced to mate. They wanted to raise these wonderful German children. Well, the trouble was that my friend Stella did not get pregnant. She got syphilis instead. Well, that happened, I think, many people during those years. Anyway, she died of it.
Oh, no, that's horrible. Yeah, that program, I think, was called the Lebensborn program, and it was one of the unspeakable, among the many unspeakable things of the era.
Terrible, terrible. But also the fact that there was no food, that in the winter she was freezing because there was no heat, and Rome could get very cold in the winter, strangely. Also, then we had gone back to London also, and we saw many friends in London. All these people were living in abject poverty, and some of them in ruins of houses that just had one room left. London had been bombed, as you know, to smithereens, and all I could see were people on crutches and with only one leg, one arm. It was a horrible, horrible situation.
Yeah.
Of course, now that's going on in the Middle East.
Yes, true enough. Well, on a happier note, though, it was in Rome that you met Lucas, your husband-to-be. Tell me how you first encountered Lucas and what your initial impressions were.
Well, I was sitting in the salotto, or the living room, there was a nice big fire going in the fireplace. It was October, and it was already getting cold. There was a dreadful thunderstorm outside, and suddenly a huge bolt of lightning, and the door flew open. There was a big, huge oak door at the academy. The door flew open, and there was a young man, and he was wearing a cape that was flying up behind him, and he walked in, looked around, and said, "Any food left?"
Well, except for that opening line, it sounds very Byron-like, actually, but...
Well, anyway... And it took about a year before we actually got together and fell in love and then finally secretly got married.
Because secretly?
Because I was only 19, which was dreadful. And I knew my parents would not approve.
Aside from the fact that he was young and good-looking and brilliant, and also had a not dissimilar background, he was born Fuchs, not Foss, and... his family also had to flee Germany because they were Jewish. What were the things that you know, made you fall in love with Lucas?
Well, first of all, let me just tell you that even though he was born Fuchs, his father decided that it would not be a good idea to have that name in America by some silly friend of his. Okay. At any rate, he decided to change his name to Foss. And Lucas was furious about it and said, no, I refuse to do that. I'm going to keep my name. And his father said, well, you can't. because your brother is going to be called Voss, and you can't have a different name from your brother.
Aside from the fact that you had studied the piano, it was part of the upbringing of a young lady of the upper classes, well-educated and well-brought up. Your background wasn't primarily musical, and his was. Was that something that particularly appealed to you, that he wasn't from the same discipline as you, and that he...
No, I loved him because he was such an extraordinary human being. He was so amazingly intelligent, had such extraordinary ideas about things. I admired him, respected him, and thought he was just incredible. He was.
And I understand you were married at the Campidoglio?
Yes, secretly.
Secretly. So when your parents found out, what did they say?
Well, nobody thought it was peculiar. Perfectly normal. I mean, don't forget, the American Academy in Rome is full of artists and scholars. Right. Which means that these are all people who have learned how to think outside the box, so to speak.
And you resettled in America. Where were you at first? I've seen a photograph, a really beautiful photograph, of you and Lucas at Tanglewood, and you're turning the page of a rather moth-eaten-looking upright piano, and then facing that piano is another equally moth-eaten-looking piano with Leonard Bernstein playing, and I'm guessing it's Felicia turning the pages for him. So that must have been fairly soon after you returned to America.
Actually, no? That's a sort of well-known photograph, and yeah. What it doesn't show is that there was a big audience out in front they were playing for and that we were helping with, because they suddenly said, we don't have any page turners, this is terrible, come on. You have to turn the paper for us. Well, neither Felicia nor I knew how to read music. So that was a problem. We were totally terrified. And I don't know if you can see it in our faces, but we were. But it went beautifully.
Cornelia, you're now back in the United States. And I take it that it wasn't too long before you had... two other members of your family join? What stage were you? Were you in New York? Were you already in Los Angeles when the children were born?
I was in Los Angeles, and it was all quite beautiful, except that I didn't like Los Angeles very much. But I was so happy about having these two children and very busy because I was also going to art school. And that's really where I started to learn to paint, because there were some very good teachers there, Howard Warsaw, et cetera, and Rico Lebrun, et cetera. And then there were so many interesting concerts as well. So we had a very good time.
So Lucas became the youngest ever full professor at UCLA. And, you know, astonishingly enough, he succeeded Arnold Schoenberg as the professor of composition. So you must have been at the center of an enormously rich circle of intellects and artists and people in and around the film industry. Can you talk a little bit about your social set during that period?
We didn't have a social set. It was a helter-skelter sort of thing. And whoever happened to be around and whoever happened to be interesting and nice and kind, we made friends with. So there were many, many people. And by the way, one of the best friends that I had was Trude Schoenberg, who was the widow of Arnold Schoenberg, who couldn't have been nicer. She was much older than I was, of course, but she was so sweet and so such a wonderful human being. I adored her.
And of course, her husband had been a painter, too, although he's...
He was not only a painter, he was a great painter. When I first met her, she showed me the whole house and then showed me the special room where all his paintings were. And I was blown away. They were so spectacular. And to this day, I can't understand why he hasn't been celebrated more. He should be.
He absolutely should be. I mean, as an expressionist I mean, some of his self-portraits are incredible, and in some cases, very powerful and slightly disturbing at times.
But I'm not so easily disturbed.
Well, you have a strong constitution. I assume that musicians who are passing through and performing with the LA Philharmonic and the Opera Company would also find their way to you?
There were also these extraordinary concerts called Concerts on the Roof. And there were so many musicians and so many European ones, by the way. Piatigorsky was a great friend. And of course, yes, we had dinner with Stravinsky and his wife, Vera, I think it was Friday or Thursday, I can't remember. And either it was at their house or at our house. And we saw them every single week. And we were very good friends.
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, I sometimes get the impression that he was very funny, but also could be very austere. Is that a correct impression?
Well, he was a serious person. He was
yes.
Extremely serious person. But austere, no. He was... I was laughing because I'm remembering that he used to have a little silver flask, and he would sort of get me to come over and say, "Cornelia, stand in front of me, please." And I'd stand in front of him, and he would have a sip of his flask so that Vera wouldn't see him because she would get too upset.
That's very funny. Did your paths cross with people in the film business?
Yes, some of them. Oh, yes. The Panamas were very good friends of ours. And then all sorts of, Betty Bacall was a good friend. And there were many people. It was Hepburn.
Catherine Hepburn.
Walked in one day. Because our house was on a hillside, so one could sort of go up some steps and come in the window. And
right.
He was taking a nap. And she wanted to show someone this wonderful house that we were staying in, which was fantastic. Anyway, she walked in, and Milton jumped up and forgot that he was totally nude. And she kept right on going, shook his hand, and said hello, and said, "Will you ever forgive me?"
That is hilarious.
And then asked him if they could see the rest of the house, and he said, "Feel free," and got right back into bed.
It's interesting because Hollywood was one of the great havens for people who had fled the war, including many musicians, like, for example, the Previns, and Korngold, and as well as many people who were not part of the film industry. They all seemed to gravitate to the West Coast for the climate or just the fact that there were other people who were like-minded there for them to associate with. So, all right. So now, Eliza and Christopher, you've been very patient, but now you are definitely part of the scene. You've arrived. How early did you realize that you were growing up in a rather extraordinary environment with extraordinary parents in an extraordinary setting?
You know, I was really quite young myself when we finally left Los Angeles after our house burnt to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That was a little traumatic. My mother says if I ever consider seeing a therapist, she said, "Well, I know what you should be talking about, and that's the fact that the house burnt to the ground, and all your everything you owned with it."
Right.
I have a slight memory of us evacuating the house and seeing that horrible, eerie red glow in the distance of the fire approaching.
That would be 1961, as they call it the fire of 61. And I understand, Cornelia, that you were preparing for a show, that you'd already had a show or two, but there was a big one coming up, and all of your work was in the house and all of it was destroyed.
Well, it was very strange because the head of the art department at UCLA called me up and told me that they were starting a gallery that was going to be part of UCLA and that they wanted the first show to be mine, which was a big honor. I was very happy about it. Then he called me back about 3 weeks later and said, Cornelia, I'm so sorry, but we've just found out that the people who are going to be running the gallery are drug dealers. So I'm herewith asking you to take all your paintings back from the gallery as fast as you can, because we can't be responsible, and we're pulling out as well. So I took all the paintings. I got a truck and got all the paintings back to our house. The next morning, I woke up, and the air was very strange and still, and I suddenly saw this red glow. And I tried to save my husband's music, but it was hard to find because it was sort of scattered. I did finally get some of it. That evening, he came back. He was away. He was in New York, as a matter of fact, because Lenny was just conducting his time cycle at the time, and with the New York Philharmonic. So he came back and heard the news on the radio, on the speaker in the plane, that Los Angeles was on fire. And came back and went with a friend to see if our house was still standing, found out that it wasn't. And it was so incredibly sweet. But mm-hmm. then I told him that I had saved his music, and he said, oh, darn, I was hoping that it would go up in flames. Oh,
dear. But still, I mean, what a horrendous thing. First of all, because people lose their lives in fires like that, so there's the fear of for your safety. But also, all of your work, after the disappointment about the show at the gallery, and then you didn't even have that again, and you really had to start again from scratch, right?
Well, I didn't have to start from scratch, but I had to do more paintings, and it was upset. It was terribly upsetting, yes.
Of course, yes.
I really had I'd done a whole series of very large paintings, sort of 7 feet by 8 feet, of strange creatures. They were sort of paintings of dancing ghosts. I think it had something to do with the Holocaust, which I wasn't aware of. I really had no idea what I was doing.
But it found its way into your inspiration. The fire obviously was a huge life-changing traumatic experience. Did you leave Los Angeles right after that? Did you stay in Los Angeles for a while?
I think we only stayed a few months because I was pregnant and I gave birth to my adorable daughter. It was really hard to move at that time.
Right.
I was staying in a rented place, which was pretty. And finally, when she was born, after about 6 months, we had a wonderful invitation from Elliot Carter and his wife. They were so incredibly kind because they said, well, it must be hard for you. And we happen to be going to the American Academy in Rome for a year. Our apartment will be empty. And wouldn't you like to stay in our apartment in New York? And I couldn't think of anything nicer. I said, are you sure? Because we have a baby and a four-year-old. They said, it's fine, don't worry. We accepted and we went to New York.
So you basically traded one coast, which is a great intellectual, musical, visual arts center, for another. And of course, you had mentioned Leonard Bernstein, who was a friend and a colleague and an admirer of Lucas's. So you were closer to home base for Lenny and the New York Philharmonic. Did you see them a lot?
Oh, yes. Every week. Absolutely.
Can you share any recollections about Bernstein? I mean, he's such a powerful figure in terms of bringing classical music to a wide audience, a whole generation of kids who were brought up with his young people's concerts?
One particular instance sort of stands out in my mind because we were there for dinner, and actually I think Felicia was not there that evening. But Mr. Rubinstein was there for dinner. Or no, I'm so, yes, it was Mr. Rubinstein. And we were all talking, and at one point Lucas said something about the Beethoven, and I mean the humor in Beethoven, upon which Rubinstein said, "What? There is no humor in Beethoven." Upon which both Lucas and Letty ran to the piano. They practically collided because they were both going to try to show him how much humor there was.
There you go. There is humor in Beethoven. You just have to know where to look. Well, not too long after, you're off to Buffalo. And that must have seemed like a bit of a change of pace, because Buffalo is, first of all, has been a great center of culture, but mostly associated earlier in the 20th century, before times got harder. But Lucas made an enormous mark on the musical life and culture of Buffalo. He started a new music festival. But you kids were now transported to Buffalo. How was it, you know, spending some of your formative years there?
I mean, what was I then? At that point, I was 3. I remember sitting maybe in the front row and looking up at my father adoringly. But yeah. And then we left for Toronto when I was about 6.
Well, yes. And that brings us to Toronto and Glenn Gould. So, Cornelia, first of all, when did you first meet Glenn Gould?
End of part one. The Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to keep bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca, and follow us across social media at the Glenn Gould Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of The Gould Standard.